This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Good talk. With your permission, I'm going to deviate from the advertised title of the shiur, and I'm going to deal with that title next week, because there's a linkage that needs to take place between last week's shiur and next week's shiur. There's an interesting statement of the Medrash that comes on this week's Sedra, where we're told, Ki sovoyu el Eretz Chanan v'nosati nega toras b'veis Eretz Achuzaschem. One of the things that will happen when you come into the land of Canaan and you take over the land is that houses are going to become afflicted with some kind of disease that the buildings were able to get. And depending on the severity of the disease and so on, certain bricks from the house might have to be removed, and in fact it's even possible that the entire building, that the entire house might have to be demolished. And the Chazal give various different reasons for that. The one is that it comes in response to narrowness, to meanness, so that if you ask a person if he's got a particular item to lend you, and he says no, he doesn't have such a thing, and then his house gets tzaraas and they have to remove everything from the house, and the neighbors walk around outside and they see laid outside all the things that he said he never had, and that embarrasses him, so it brings it on, it brings it outside as the consequence of him being mean. And another view is that the Canaanim used to hide their treasures in the behind the bricks and the building and the walls of their homes, and when the Bnei Israel conquered the land, they got the houses, but they didn't know that there was treasure in them, and they didn't know where the treasure was. So when a house got tzaraas, it was at first a terrible tragedy for the person. His house has got this disease, and the Kohen has to come, and it might have to be demolished. The Kohen looks at it and says, "Yeah, to demolish the house." But in so doing, they often discovered all sorts of treasure in the walls of the building. And then the Medrash goes on, and we're only going to do the first part of the Medrash, quoting a couple of interesting posuks, and says, "Adu dichtiv." This is what it means when it says, "Ach toiv li Yisrael Elokim leborei levov." Posuk in Tehillim. God is only good to the Jewish people, to those who are pure of heart. Explains the Medrash, Yochel Lakol. The first part of the sentence is, Ach toiv li Yisrael Elokim. Hashem is good to the Jewish people. Maybe that's a blanket statement that Hashem is good to all Jews. Talmud Lema, Laborei Levov, Elo Shelibon Bori B'mitzvahs. No, it's only specific Jews. Those who are pure in their hearts, that means that their hearts are pure in the fulfillment of mitzvahs. Another one. Ashrei Odom Oiz Loi Boch. Happy is the man who finds strength in you. Yochel Lakol. Maybe that means every person who finds strength in you will be happy. Talmud Loma, but the pasuk goes on and qualifies that and says, "Mesilois bilavovom elu deshvilin d'oraisa kvishin b'livoi." Only those where the paths of Torah are well paved in their minds. Another one, "Heitivo Hashem latoivim." Hashem does good to good people. Yochel lakol. Maybe it means to all good people. Talmud Loma. No, there's a qualification. "Vale yeshori velishorim bilaboisom." No, only to those who straighten their hearts. Another one, Tov Hashem l'mo'iz b'yom tzoro. Hashem is good as a fortification, as a strength in days of trouble. Yochel l'kol, maybe he's good for everybody. Talmud l'ma v'yodea chosei boi. No, to those who trust in him. Korov Hashem l'chol korov, we say in Ashrei, Hashem is close to all who call him. Yochel l'kol, does that really mean to anybody who calls Hashem, that Hashem is near to them? Talmud Loma, no, there's a qualification. L'chol Hashem yikru v'emes. Only those who call Hashem in truth. So in each of these cases, there's a general statement of Hashem responding to people, where the general statement seems to be that Hashem responds wonderfully to all sorts of people, and that's followed by a specific, implying that it's not really all sorts of people, there's a qualification, not everybody, only if the following qualification applies, and it lists various different qualifications which we'll analyze in greater detail a little later. But what's interesting is this whole principle of klal uprat, as we call it, ein bichlal alamash viprat. Sometimes the Torah gives a general statement and follows it with a specific statement, and we then learn that the general statement is qualified by that specific statement, that Ein Bichlal Elo Ma Shebi Prat, although the general statement appears to be general, it isn't general. And it really has to focus, and it applies only to those that qualify to the specifics of the second statement. Now, it's a difficult principle to understand in general, and certainly over here. If it's only the specifics, why not say so? Why mislead us? For example, that pasuk from Ashrei, why say Korov Hashem l'chol korov? Hashem is close to all who call on Him. L'chol ha'shikru v'emes. Provided you call in truth. Why don't they just say Hashem is close to everybody who calls Him in truth? And finished with it. From the first pasuk, Ach tov l'Yisrael elokim. Why does it say Hashem is good to the Jewish people? But to which Jewish people? Laborei levav. Only if they are pure of heart. Why doesn't it just say Hashem is good to the Jews who are pure of heart? Why go through the process of almost raising expectations and saying a general statement that includes everybody and then narrowing it down to but not everybody really. We say in the beginning of Pirkei Avos there, from Perikhele, Kol Yisrael Yeshlam Chelech Ve'Olam Haba. Every Jew has a part in Olam Haba. A little bit later starts, Ve'Elu She'en Lohem Chelech Olam Haba. And here come the list of people who don't have a part in Olam Haba. There's this almost deliberate attempt to make a general statement that sounds totally enticing, and then to qualify it and say, but it doesn't apply to everybody. But to understand that medrash, I'm going to refer back to an earlier medrash that we started dealing with last night. Amar Rabbi Simloi, the beginning of Parshas Tazria, the medrash says, Rabbi Simloi said, K'shem sheyetzirosoi shel odom achar behemo chayov oif, just as man was created after the animals and the wild animals and the birds, kach tzirosoi achar behemo chayov oif. So when the Torah, the halachas, the laws that apply to man also come after the animals. Last week we learned in the Sedra Zois Torah Sabahimo, the Torah listed all the laws that apply to animals, which animals are kosher and which are not kosher. V'achar koch isho ki tazriya. And then it says after that, it starts with this week's Sedra, about if a woman has a child, what her dinim are, if she has a baby, what her dinim are, the dinim of nida, all the various different laws that apply to the human being. So you see, just as man was created last, so his halachas are given to us last. Which is very strange. Firstly, they're not all given to us last. There are many halachas that are given before last week's Sedra. Last week's Sedra wasn't the first parasha in the Torah. All the halachas that came before, we've had hundreds of halachas already that have come before last week's Sedra. So what does it mean that the laws of animals are given before the laws of the human being? And secondly, an earlier medrash, just a few lines earlier, says the following. Al daite d'reish lokish k'siv v'ruach elukim rachefes al p'nei hamayim ze ruchu shel melech hamashiach. It says in the very first day of creation that the Spirit of Hashem was hovering over the face of the water. What is that Spirit of Hashem that was hovering? Says the Medrash, in the name of Resh Lakish, Ze Ruchoi Shel Melech HaMashiach. That was the spirit, the soul of the Mashiach. Hashem actually created the soul of the Mashiach on that first day. What is the soul of the Mashiach? That is the ultimate human soul. The ultimate spirituality, of the ultimate potential of the human being. The soul of the Mashiach. In Zocha Odom, if a man merits it, Oimrim Loi, then we say to him, a man is great, we say, Ato kadom kadanta l'chol ma'asei bereshis. You know, when you were created, before anything else, on the very first day of creation, Hashem says, it says in the Torah, Ruach Elokim rachefes al pnei hamayim. And what is that Ruach Elokim that was hovering? It was you, man, it was you who was so great, that you were created before anything else. Ve'im lav, but if a person is not great, Oimrim loy, we say to him, Yitush kadom cho, shilshul kadom cho, who are you? A little mosquito was created before you. The little worms in the ground were created before you. What are you? What do you do? You think so much of yourself? So we see that the spirit of man was created on the first day, and the body of man was created on the last day. In that case, what does the Medrash mean when it says that just as the Torah, just as man was created last, so his Torah was given after the animals? Torah belongs to the spiritual realm. And the spiritual part of man was created before the animals. So surely the Torah that applies to the spiritual part of the human being should have been given before the animals, not after the animals. It's only the body of the man that was created after the animals. And I left that question last night, hoping that people would have a look at the Medrash and would work out some answers, which maybe people did do. that for those of you who weren't here last night, I'd better give you the answer. There's a very important yesod, there's a very important principle in this medrash, and that is that there are two completely different aspects, two completely different parts of the human being, as we know. But we don't always understand the extent to which those parts are different and separate. There is the human soul, and there is the human body. But it's not just the soul and the body. The soul has a whole system that goes with it, and the body has a whole system that goes with it. The soul functions in a certain way, and the body functions in another way. The soul reacts in certain ways, and the body reacts in different ways. They're two completely different systems that come together in the human being and function side by side. And as we suggested last night, it's not impossible that the physical side of the human being evolved. It's not impossible. Scientists claim it evolved. In Chazal, all we can see for sure is that the human being as we have him, the totality of the human being, didn't evolve. But that the human body in part might have evolved could be very difficult to tell from the Torah. In fact, from this medrash, there appears to be some kind of credence that it evolved. I'm not interested scientifically whether it evolved or not. What I'm interested in really is spiritually and morally, where it fits in into the hierarchy of beings. And consider for a moment evolution scientifically, irrespective of whether it's right or wrong in terms of Torah. It's not terribly relevant, but its implications are relevant. What does evolution mean, really? Evolution means that in essence we are sophisticated animals. That's what it means. And it means in essence a sophisticated animal. What's the less a less sophisticated animal than us is the ape and the gorillas and the monkeys. And so you go down and you can say a monkey is just an intelligent next one down. I don't know who was the one just before the monkeys. I think elephants are much more intelligent than monkeys, but that doesn't seem to be the scale of evolution. Whoever it is, it doesn't make any difference. But at the end of the day, you track it down, and you've got to come to the conclusion that in essence, we're just one-celled kind of amoebas, or whatever was the origin of the process of evolution. That's what we really are. We have simply evolved from that one little start, and in essence, that's what we are. So when the Medrash says that if a person isn't great, Omrim Loi, we say to him, Yitush Kadomcho, Shilshul Kadomcho, it's not just to say that the mosquito was there before you, that the worm was there before you. So what difference does it make who was there before you? Is that what determines how great you are? Who was created first? That's not the essence of it. What we're saying is they were there before you, and according to your own science of evolution, that's what you come from. That's who you are. That if they were there before you and you developed from them, that's what you claim. That's what a purely secularist approach claims. If you remove all the religious dimension from that kind of thinking and you look at the process of creation from a purely secular point of view, and that's what Imloi Zocho means. If a person sees only the secular side of himself, if he sees only the physical side of himself, then you must come to Darwin's conclusion. You have no choice but to come to Darwin's conclusion. If there's no Ribono Shel Olam, if there's no God in it, what are you? What can you be? It's interesting, I'm consulting to a very big organization at the moment, and the person in charge there says that he's tried to do all the things that I've done there in that organization, he's tried to do, and it didn't work. And he can't figure out why not. What have I done that he couldn't do? And he's an extremely intelligent person, and a very fine person, highly educated, several doctorates. And he's really worked very hard, and he has done a lot, but he couldn't put it all together. And I said to him, well, what do you think of it? Is the difference between you and me? He said, well, I think the only difference, he's not Jewish, but he said, I think the only difference between you and me is that you believe that there's something divine about human beings, and I believe they're animals. I believe they're clever animals. I believe they've come very far, but there's no God in my world. I said, oh, that's the only difference. You're right, that's the only difference. There's a limit to how far you can think. If you remove God from your thinking, then you cannot conclude that man is anything but an animal. It's not possible. Where does he come from? What is he? He's a clever animal, that's all. And if he's a clever animal, you've got to say, so where does he come from? He comes from the ape. From where does the ape come? Eventually you get down to the worm and the mosquito. And notice the Medrash doesn't say the amoeba. Because the amoeba is quite a fascinating little creature, quite attractive. Not so the worm and the mosquito. So sometimes when you say to, when the evolutionists say, you know, you come from an amoeba, that we can still tolerate, or some people can tolerate, I wouldn't be able to, but some people can still tolerate, amoeba, okay, harmless little thing, I was once an amoeba, now look what I am. But when you tell a person you were once a worm and a mosquito, that's quite intolerable. But that's what you've got to assume if you follow evolution to its natural conclusion, and you must follow evolution if you don't believe in the Ribono Shel Olam, then Yitush Kadomcho, Shilshul Kadomcho, then at your origins, at some point near the starting point, that's where you've emerged from. You've come from the mosquito, you've come from the worm, that's who you are. And in that case, you've got to say that man has come a long way. Then you've actually, things look pretty good. Then you've got to say, if I was once a mosquito, I was once a worm, yeah, that's my origin, but look where I am today. Look where mankind has developed to. And again, if you follow the theory of evolution, there's a great deal to be proud of. There's a great deal to be quite arrogant about. Look what mankind has achieved. Look where we've come. Look where we started. Look where we've developed to. Look where we are today. The ability that man has had to survive all circumstances, to dominate the world, to master the world, to create, to invent. It's incredible where man has come. So following the evolutionary system, man has come from very humble origins, and he has developed into something very magnificent. Source of great pride and bordering on enormous arrogance. What about if you follow the spiritual, the godly side? Then you say, but one second, before there were mosquitoes, and before there were worms, and before there was even an amoeba or even water in which the amoeba could live, or oxygen for the amoeba to breathe, I already existed. Because on the first day, before it all, Ruach Elokim merachefes al pnei hamayim, there was the origins of the human spirit. And where did the origin of that human spirit come from? It came from the Ribono Shel Olam, and from God himself. So in that sense, you've got to say, I evolved from that spirit that was created on the first day. But that's not evolution, because evolution implies a certain growth process, a certain development. If you start from an amoeba and you land up a human being, that's evolution. But if you start as the Ruach Elokim merachefes al pnei hamayim, if you start being the Spirit of God itself, the Ruchoi Shel Melech HaMashiach, the Spirit of the Mashiach on the first day, and you look at yourself today, and you say, my goodness, what's happened to me? Look what I used to be, and look what I am today. It's exactly the opposite dynamic. So whereas if you're looking at it secularly, you see a process of evolution. If you look at it spiritually, you see a process of devolution, where you start with something outstanding, superb and perfect, and it devolves to what we are today. And the truth is that both of them are occurring simultaneously within the human being. The opportunity to understand it this way is emphasized also in Sefer Bereishis, in the, both the Sipurnu and in the Ramban. The Sipurnu says on the Pasuk, Vayipach be'apov nishmas chayim, Hashem breathed into us the spirit of life. Vayehi ha'odom lenefesh chayon, the man became a living being. Unculus translates that, Vahavas be'odom leruach memalolo, that was the point at which the human being became capable of speech, capable of communication, and therefore capable of rationalization, of thinking. And even there's an implication, but before that stage, whether that stage was a few moments or that stage was any other period of time, we don't know, and it's not clear what extent of time that was, but there was a period of time where the human being was not a Ruach Mamalala, where he could not communicate. It was only when God breathed his spirit in that man could communicate. But the Sipurnu and the Ramban, according to one view in the Ramban, take it even further. The Sipurnu says, On vayehi ha'odom lenefesh chayo, and man became a living soul. Says the Sipurnu, Hoyo im kol ze chayo bilvad. But nevertheless, at this point, he was only an animal. That's not quoted from Darwin's Origin of Species, that's quoted from the Sipurnu in Bereishis. At that point where the Torah says, Vayehi Odom Lenefesh Chayo, says the Sipurnu, that means at that point man was an animal. Bilti Medaberes. Unable to communicate. Ad Shenivro Betzeli Mudmus. Until God took that animal and gave him the image of Hashem. At that point he didn't have the image of Hashem. Only when he got the image of Hashem did he actually develop the capacity to think and to communicate. So clearly the Sipurnu says, there was a phase in the creation of man. And again, if Darwin wants to argue that was thousands of years, and the Torah wants to tell us it was seconds or moments or hours, we don't know what it was. But there was a phase in the development of man where man was an animal. And that animal could well have evolved from the other animal species, or could have been created on the, along the line, but it has an animal system. That being, that human being who was not yet a human being, functioned according to an animal system. He didn't function with a human system. He didn't have a soul. He didn't have a spirit. He couldn't think. He couldn't communicate. His system was an animal system, not a human system. And the Ramban says something very, very similar. He says, first, the first stage was Hashem created us from dust of the earth. And when God created us from the sand of the earth, we were like an unmoving stone. We were mineral. We weren't even animal. He goes back further. He says, human beings started off as mineral. Then Hashem breathed into him a breath of life. And then man became capable of locomotion. Man could move, like the animals and the fish, but not yet a human being. And only at the next stage, as the Sifurna learns, did he become a human being. So clearly, there was a phase, the animal involvement, the physical evolution of the human being, whether it was Darwin's evolution or a different evolution that the Torah seems to have in mind, or a creation, whatever it was, there was a stage where man functioned only as an animal system, and then he was given a spiritual side to him as well, and that spiritual side was created on the first day, not on the sixth day. On the sixth day the physical side came to fruition, but already God had created the spiritual side and he merged them together on the sixth day. That being the case, we have got to look at ourselves with a certain split identity. We've actually got to see ourselves as three beings. We've got to see ourselves as the Ruach Elokim Rachefes Al Pnei Adamah. We've got to see ourselves as this godly spirit. We've got to see ourselves as this physical being, this physical body. And we've got to see ourselves as the merging of the two together, as the synthesis of the two together. But we've got to recognize the components. We can't handle ourselves, we can't manage ourselves if we don't understand the components from which we're made. We can't just look at ourselves in the mirror and say, human being. That human being is a synthesis of two separate components. Each component carries on functioning with its own system. And that's the way Chazal say, Al-Korchecho Atochai, Al-Korchecho Nivro, Al-Korchecho Atanoilod. There is a living force which takes place involuntarily. The force of life, the involuntary muscles that keep that heart beating, that keep the lungs expanding, that's an involuntary process of life that is not governed by your soul. That's not governed by any kind of decision. That's a mechanical system with which the human being is built, just like the lions have got it, and the monkeys have got it, and the cats, and the mice, and the insects. Everybody's got a system, every creature has a system that keeps it functioning. And the human being is no different. He also has a system that keeps him functioning as a living organism. And we have to recognize that. That's one part of us. Another part of us is the Ruach Elokim, the Spirit of Hashem. And where we start becoming successful is when we understand the synthesis, how to synthesize those two, how to keep those systems overlapping properly, how to keep those systems running in tandem and not pulling in conflict with one another. Because those systems are in conflict. The one is evolving and the one is devolving. And in fact, if you look at it, there's a further interesting dynamic and opposite dynamic, and that is that mankind, physically, is evolving, and spiritually is devolving. Mankind is becoming more and more sophisticated physically. He's becoming greater and greater technologically. Spiritually, he's becoming smaller and smaller. Not just in religious terms, even in secular terms. There aren't any more Shakespeare's, there aren't any more Mozart's, there aren't any more Beethoven's. And even though people want to argue, in their lifetime, they also weren't recognized. No, but halavai, there should be people today who are not recognized like they weren't recognized in their time. We don't have that quality of creativity in areas other than technology. Only in technology have we advanced enormously. In all other areas, we've taken steps backwards. We're not producing the literature of days gone by. We're not producing the art of days gone by. We're not producing the music of days gone by. We're not producing the philosophy of days gone by. And we're not producing certainly the Torah, the spirituality, and the purity of days gone by. So mankind is evolving technically and physically, and he is devolving spiritually. But the individual man is exactly the opposite. As we discussed last week in the process of aging, physically, man is deteriorating, the individual. He's devolving. He reaches his heights very early on in life. And then he starts deteriorating. Spiritually, he's improving. So while mankind evolves technically, the individual man devolves technically. While mankind devolves spiritually, the individual man evolves spiritually. Look at the complexity of the human being. So as an individual, you're living in a dynamic where your spiritual side is growing and your physical side is declining. And as humanity, as a grouping, you're living in a situation where your physical side is improving and your spiritual side is declining. And all these dynamics are working together with one another. Again, and I'd be surprised then why you can't understand a human being, why we can't understand how people function. We're extremely complex, extremely complex. But it's important to recognize that aspect of us as well. That apart from being this complex, sophisticated human being capable of all sorts of thoughts and all sorts of wonderful inventions and creations, and that we have this ability to spiritually elevate ourselves right up to the highest of high levels, it's important to understand at the same time there is a part of us that is very basic and very primitive. It's just an old animal body that functions the same as any other animal's body. And we have to recognize that and be in touch with that. And just as there are halachas that govern the various objects that we come into contact with, we come into contact with the vegetable world, the halachas that govern the vegetable world. Laws of Shemitah, laws of Truma, laws of Maisa. We come into contact with the mineral world. There are laws that govern the mineral world. How we can utilize it, what we can utilize. The animal world, there are laws that govern the animal, the way we handle the animal world. Certain things are kosher, certain things are not kosher. How you shecht an animal, how you kasher an animal. All these things, milk and meat together. Likewise, we've got to look at ourselves as a lump of meat too. There's a part of us which is just a lump of meat. And there are halachas that govern that lump of meat. That's all. And if you look at the halachas in these two sedras in Tazria and Metzora, they are all the halachas that are the result of the function of the normal, natural functioning of the human mechanism, of the animal mechanism. They have nothing to do with spirituality. The laws govern, of course the laws have to do with spirituality, but what they govern has nothing to do with spirituality. They talk about various emissions from the sexual organs, it talks about childbirth, it talks about disease of different types. It's physical manifestations of physical symptoms of the normal process of an animal body functioning. And just as there are laws that govern any other animal body that we come into contact, there are laws that govern our own body. And there are laws that focus on the animal side. And that's why the Medrash is absolutely aligned with it. The Medrash says the Torah HaOdom comes after Torah HaBehemah. It's not talking about the laws that govern the way we, as spiritual beings, relate to the rest of the world. Those laws we've had already, and there are more to come, but a lot of them we've had already. Here we're talking about the laws that govern us as objects, not us as subjects. My body is an object, as well as I am a subject. I am able to act on the world. I am able to do things. I am able to think. But that's the big me. But one component of the big me is the little me. That's just the body. That's an object. And there are halachas that govern that object. The halachas of Tazria Metzora, Tumo and Tyro and all sorts of things, but they're all bodily functions. The human body was created after the animals. The human body was created after the mosquito and the worm. And the Torah reminds us of that when it gives us the halachas that govern the human body. They come after the halachas that govern the animal body. But not after the laws that govern the animal, the human psyche. Not after the laws that govern the human way of thinking. And that's why it's quite in order to say, Zocho, if a person is great, if he's living as a spiritual being, if he's predominantly spiritual, then we say a being like you was conceived of before anything else in the world. But if you're predominantly physical, in Loi Zocho, then we say, if you're a physical being, then where do you come from? You come from mosquitoes and worms, that's all you are. It's nothing much. And that's emphasized by saying that physical part of you, the laws that govern the physical part of you, are given to us after the laws that govern the animals. And that's interesting too, because in a sense, as animals, we're probably the most inefficient animals that there are. The only reason we've survived is because we have intellect. The only reason we've survived is because we have the ability to adapt, the ability to create, the ability to modify our environments. But if we didn't have all that, if you gave us the brains of chimpanzees, we would have been wiped out long ago. We wouldn't have been able to survive. We're not efficient animals as animals go. And that's also part of what it means. Shulshul kadomcha, yitush kadomcha. Mosquitoes function more efficiently than we do. Worms function more efficiently than we do. There's nothing really to be proud of us as animal beings. Because although we're evolving technologically, the reason we're evolving is because we're using our minds. But if you took us on a purely animal level, we're not the most efficient of animals. The existence of this animal side of us, or the recognition, the acceptance of this animal side of us, is very important. It's very important from a number of points of view. So yes, on one hand, we are active beings, we are subjects, we are capable of impacting on the world around us, we are capable of manipulating, of managing, of leading. That's all a function of the human part of us. On the other hand, we are bodies. We are animal, we have an animal side to us that functions with an animal system, and we are subject to all the impacts upon us from our environment. So when it's cold outside, we get cold. When it's hot outside, we get hot. There's nothing we can do about that. We can do something in the sense of we can make clothes for ourselves, and we can turn on the air conditioning, and we can turn on the heating. There are things that our minds allow us to do, but that's using the human side of us. But the animal side of us needs to acknowledge the normal and natural experiences of that animal side. But most important of that is to be able to acknowledge that aspect of human weakness. If we were only the Ruach Elokim Merachefes al Pnei HaMayim, if that's all we were, if we were that Spirit of God, there would be no weakness. We wouldn't suffer any kind of weakness at all. We would never be embarrassed. We would never be ashamed. We would never be depressed. We would never be hot or never be cold or never be tired. We would be godly. We would be a chelek eloi kamimal, and that would be it. The fact of our weakness comes from the fact that we're not that, that there is another part of the system. And we have to be in touch with that part of the system as well. We have to be able to acknowledge, firstly within ourselves, and secondly within one another, that it's okay to be hungry, that it's okay to be tired, that it's okay to be depressed, that it's okay to be miserable. It's normal, it's okay, there's nothing wrong with it. Because there is an animal part. One has to understand that. You can't start rectifying it unless you recognize it within yourself, and certainly within other people. And perhaps that's even the more important part, is to recognize that weakness, that vulnerability, let's say, rather than weakness, that vulnerability that exists within other people. Because if you don't recognize vulnerability in other people, there isn't the beginning of an engagement process. We spoke in the Ladies' Shiur this morning of the difference between interaction and engagement. People often interact with each other, but they seldom engage with one another. And in order to engage with one another, it's necessary to be able to notice the other person's vulnerability and be sensitive and responsive to that person's vulnerability. But if the person comes over as being invulnerable, if he comes over as being a Ruach Elokim Rachefes al Pnei HaMayim, he's all okay, there's nothing wrong with him at all, then that lack of vulnerability results in people not being able to engage with him. You cannot engage with a person who doesn't have some point of vulnerability. Of course, we're afraid to expose our vulnerabilities because people take advantage of it. That's the cruelty of the human being. That's when the human being functions as an animal. When he notices a weak point and he goes for it, that's the animal in the human being. But what does the godly in the human being do? When he notices the vulnerability, he sees an opportunity for chesed. He sees an opportunity for upliftment. He sees an opportunity for engagement. And that's when true relationships start to be built. It's very interesting. One of the companies that I was consulting to had a particular team in their organization, a group of people who were the heart of the organization. Without them, the company couldn't function. But they weren't functioning as a team. They were backbiting each other. They were destroying each other. They were undermining each other. It was quite a terrible situation. And they tried all sorts of things and it didn't work. So based on this piece of Torah that I'm learning with you at the moment, I came to the conclusion that what was wrong with these people is that none of them were vulnerable. They weren't engaging. They were interacting. Nobody saw the other one as being vulnerable. No one was willing to expose himself as being vulnerable for very simple reasons. They didn't trust each other to expose their vulnerability. But if you're working in a team where you look at everybody else and none of them appear to be vulnerable, and you think to yourself, I'm the only one who's vulnerable, well, I can't show them, because if I show them, they'll eat me up alive. So I've got to pretend to be invulnerable, and I've got to try and undermine them. I've got to try and break them down. And that was the kind of environment that everybody was trying to break each other down. So what we did is we took them to a Thai mountain, and we had experts with us. We didn't do it on our own. And we made sure, we tied them up with all sorts of stuff, and basically threw them over the mountain in such a way, it's really genuine, but in such a way
that the only way they could survive was by exposing their vulnerability and appealing to help from all the others. And when they came down, if they were going to come down alive, they didn't know that we'd built in safety mechanisms that they would come down alive. In any case, we didn't risk their lives. But they didn't know that. You have never seen people so terrified. You have never seen these big, strong, vulnerable people shaking, white, pale, big macho men. You can't believe. And they told us before, some of them said, you know, we're prepared to come with you, but no mountain climbing, and I've got a heart condition, I've got this. I knew they would all do it, because that would be exposing vulnerability. You can't say, I can't do it, everybody else can do it, but I won't. So I knew they would all be willing to go. So with their heart conditions, with all the rest of it, they went. And as they took that step over the cliff, the shaking, the trembling, and their lives, and they thought, their lives were totally in the hands of the other people in their team. And when they got back to town, do they work beautifully together? Do they relate beautifully together? They engaged. They saw, they realized they're all normal human beings. They have a physical side to them. They're scared sometimes. They were in tears, some of them. Some of them were crying. They'd never done that before. And they'd seen each other. Once you've seen that, the ability to interrelate was totally different. There was only one person in that team who they'd been wanting to get rid of for ages. And he left straight afterwards. He couldn't take the possibility that others should have seen him crying. He resigned and left, which was the best thing for them. And then the team came together. What was it that came together? The acknowledgement of weakness, the understanding we're not Ruach Elokim Ruach Efes Al Pnei HaMayim. We're human beings, we can make mistakes. Our ability to function depends on the support we get from one another. We can have bad days, we can have good days, we have ups, we have downs. We're complicated human beings, and we need each other's support in order to function properly. Unless we understand that element, if we look at ourselves only as this magnificent spiritual being, this wonderful human being that learns Torah and thinks in Torah all the time and that ovens beautifully and says Tehillim all day and learns and fasts on Yom Kippur and reaches these high levels, what opportunity is there for engagement? That's only one part of us. But there is another part of us, full of all the basic primitive feelings that any animal has. And the Tol Zerov says, and perhaps we'll touch on it next week in Yiratzah Hashem, that that basic animal instinct translates itself into the spiritual areas. It's not something you want to get rid of. It's not something you want to deny. That becomes a force in the process of synthesizing the two parts of the human being. Even in that, it has to be acknowledged. It has to be understood. And so in a sedra like this, we focus on the body as if it were the body of an animal functioning without the human side. Body has certain functions. Those functions have certain spiritual implications. And we need to know how to handle the spiritual implications of the physical functioning. But first we have to acknowledge that it's physical functioning. Then we can function in order. And that's part of the meaning of the laws of Nida, of the laws of family purity. Where a woman and a husband and a wife living together have to tune into the fact that the woman has a body, she has a way of functioning, that she has a certain system, and the halacha tunes into that system. That system has certain halachic implications, it has certain emotional implications, but there has to be a tuning into that system. You can't pretend that system doesn't exist. You can't not acknowledge that system. The system does exist and it forms part of life. But just as the physical system has spiritual implications, so the spiritual system has physical implications. And here one begins to see the area of overlap. Let's take those psukim that the Medrash started with in Parshas Matzora. Ach toiv li Yisrael Elokim. First pasuk it brings, Hashem is good to the Jewish people. And then the Medrash says, Lachol yochol lakol, does that mean to everybody? Talmud lo ima labore leivav, no, eili shilibon bori b'mitzvah, only certain ones. Being Jewish is part of a physical system. It has nothing to do with what you think. It has nothing to do with what kind of person you are. At the end of the day, the definition of whether you're Jewish or not is a simple definition, leaving aside the conversion element. Taking the system of normal inheritance, being Jewish is the function of being born of a Jewish mother. That's it. And it doesn't matter, you might find non-Jews who are more tuned into Yiddishkeit than a lot of Jewish people are. You might find a non-Jew able to convert and become a much better Jew than many Jewish people are. It has nothing to do with morality, and it has nothing to do with a Jewish ethic. It has to do with biological facts. That's all. If a man was born from a Jewish mother, he is Jewish. That's a biological fact. And that is a system. And that system, as the other systems in the Sedra, have certain spiritual implications. happens to be born from a Jewish mother, there are spiritual implications. He is then bound by the laws of the Torah. Just that, by a physical coincidence. His mother happens to be, his biological mother happens to be Jewish. The result of that physical fact is 613 mitzvahs.
So when it says, Ach toiv li Yisrael Elokim, Hashem is good to Yisrael, to the Jewish people.
The qualification is, Labore Levov, but only to the Jew who is Jewish, not just biologically. And what Hashem is saying here is, the qualification means, I'm explaining to you what I mean by a Jewish. There are two different meanings to a Jew. Just as there are two different meanings to the word human being. Human being can mean an animal, a clever animal, and that's what it means if you remove godliness out of it. And a human being can mean a mighty spiritual being, capable of reaching the greatest heights of spirituality. Both of them are human beings. And if you say the human, if you look at the human being and you think of him in his physical functions, doing physical things, eating, sleeping, getting tired, you think of him physically, that's okay, that's still the human being you're thinking of. If you think of him spiritually, if you think of an Avraham Avinu, a Yitzchak, a Yaakov, a Moshe Rabbeinu, that's still a human being, two different human beings. If you think of a Yisrael, if you think of an Eskimo in Alaska who happens to have a Jewish mother, he's a Jew, he's a Yisrael. But when Hashem says, Ach Tov Li Yisrael Elokim, Hashem is saying, but there's a different dimension, I'm not talking about the biological system. If you're talking about a godly response to the Jew, then that's not a godly response to the biological Jew. That's a godly response to the human element of Jewishness. And the human element of Jewishness is choice, decision, will. And that's labore lev of elu shelibon bori b'mitzvahs. What does that mean? Their hearts are pure in mitzvahs. You can have a Jew who's born biologically to a Jewish man. So he's biologically Jewish. What happens if he's born biologically to a Jewish mother and father, but not only a Jewish mother and father? They live in Mea Shearim. That's where he happens to be born. And his grandfather and grandmother were from Jews. And his great-grandfather and mother, they've never been out of Mea Shearim. Only 200 years ago, his ancestors were out of Mea Shearim, but then they came from a ghetto in Europe, which was just like Mea Shearim. And so he's born into a society where, from a system's point of view, he's from. He doesn't know anything else. It's his environment. The psychologists always talk about the effect of the environment. So what is his frumkeit base? And he keeps all the mitzvahs too beautifully. He's up early in the morning and he learns and he says tehillim and he goes to shul and he puts on his tefillin and he davens nicely and he comes home and he washes and he has his breakfast and he benches and he goes back to yeshiva and he sits and learns 100% frum. Everything he does is beautiful. But what is driving him? Is he being driven by a system, or is he being driven by a choice? That's the difference between bori b'mitzvah, shelibon bori b'mitzvah, where the heart is pure in mitzvah. He might well be that same human being that we've described, born in Mea Shearim. He might come from Alaska. It makes no difference. But the kind that it's talking about is where there has been a will, there has been a commitment, there has been a decision to be committed to the mitzvah, because that's what I want to do. That's what I have integrated for myself, because it's right, because it's true, because that's what Hashem wants, and that's how I want to do it, and I understand them as best as I'm able to understand them, I appreciate them as best as I'm able to appreciate them, and I have chosen to do it. That's the Yisrael. When it says, Ach Tov Li Yisrael Elokim, it's not just to the biological Jew, meaning neither the Jew who's merely born Jewish, nor to the Jew who's functioning as a religious Jew, but is functioning systematically. But Labori Leva, I want the one who's functioning using that human dimension, using the dimension that is devolving, not the dimension that is evolving, using that dimension that was created on the first day, not the dimension that was created on the last day. Theoretically, if man was just a clever animal, that's all he was, and you took this clever animal and you raised him in the ghettos of Europe and eventually you brought him to Mea Shearim in Yerushalayim, there's a good chance he would go through all the motions. I'm talking not about an ape, I'm talking about a clever human being like us, but take the godliness out of it. But if you put a strong environment where all he sees around him is this going on all the time, the chances are, even if he didn't have a godly side in him, he could be trained, he could be conditioned to keep all the mitzvahs. That's not what Hashem's talking about. Yes, man can be frum systematically. But when it says, Ach Tov Li Yisrael Elokim, that's the person shelibon bori b'mitzvahs, where his mind and heart has integrated the mitzvahs. And so with all of them. Ashrei Adam oiz loy boch
Happy is the man who finds strength in you, Hashem. Yochel lakol, maybe everybody. Talmud Leimar, Mesilus bilavovum elu deshvilin d'oraisa kivishin b'levi.
To find strength in Hashem when you're primitive. You're a primitive being. Find strength in God. There are all sorts of primitive beings who have had no education, whatever, and believe in God of some sort, of a God of some sort. And that's why anthropologists sometimes question, was God created by us, or did God create us? It's because it looks, you can take even primitive people and they create the concept of a God. It's convenient to believe in a God. Is that what it means when we say, Ashri Odom Ozloi Boch? That happy is the man who finds strength for himself in God? It doesn't mean primitive strength. It doesn't mean just relying on a God because that's the comfortable thing when everything else breaks down. Why not rely on a God? That's not what it means.
It means the Shvilim Doraisa Kvishim believe him.
They're paths of Torah, they've gone through Torah, they've analyzed, they've thought, they've integrated, it's become part of them. They've made religious choice. They haven't just followed a system. Shvilim Doraisa means they've reasoned it through, they've thought it through, their clarity of Torah has brought them to it. It's not just an automatic commitment.
Hetiva Hashem Latovim. Hashem is good to good people. Maybe to all of them.
There are different kinds of good people. Some people are naturally good. They're good people. They don't like doing bad things. They don't like hurting other people. That's not what it means. Hashem is good. That's a system. The fact that he's very good, that's nice, that's sweet, but doesn't mean greatness. You don't get greatness from systems. And there are some people who, by virtue of their systems, are just good. They're just kind, fine, nice people. That's not what it means. We want the kind of person who's capable of being mekayim the mitzvah of mechias amolek, a person who's capable. You know what the mitzvah of mechias amolek means? You know, everybody says we want Mashiach now. Do you know what Mashiach coming means? Mashiach will come, and what will happen if Mashiach points out to you that your business partner, who got you on your feet, has been a close friend and almost a member of your family, somebody you would trust with your life, that you've worked closely with for 40 years, Mashiach comes and says, I would like you to know, Rabbi, that partner happens to be from Amalek. So here's a revolver, go and shoot him, his wife, and his children, and his cats and dogs, and the whole lot. Now. That's what will happen when Mashiach comes. Not so simple, everything's going to be sweet and lovely when Mashiach comes. We're going to have to get rid of some pretty bad people in the process too. What are we going to do with that? How many of us would actually be able to do that? We want Mashiach now. Are we ready? Are we really ready for that? Be that as it may, we want a person who's capable of doing that to also be capable of being sweet and nice. That's because yeshorim b'libosom, there's a straightness to them. They're not nice to everybody. People who are nice to everybody are nice to nobody. One has to be discerning. You're nice to good people. You behave in a fine, in a considerate way to people who are deserving of that refinement and consideration. You sacrifice of yourself to people who appreciate your sacrifice. No obligation to be good and fine and nice to everybody that Christianity preaches, not the Torah. The Torah discerns. Sometimes there are bad people and you need to deal with them in a much harsher way than to other people who are good, and one has to have sufficient control to be able to do it where you're doing it because it's right, not because it's natural. If you're doing it because it's natural, it's part of the system. If you're doing it because it's right, it's part of your own choice. And that's what this Midrash is trying to get to in each one of them.
Korav Hashem l'chol korav. Hashem is close to everybody who calls him.
There is a reflex action to call to Hashem. And you can get a hardened atheistic soldier when he's in the trenches and the bombs are flying and people are dying on his left and people are dying on his right. He says, Ribbono shel Olam, save me. He does, although he's never believed in God. At that point he does. That's system. That's automatic. That's reflex. That's not what Hashem means when he says, Korov Hashem l'chol korov. I'm close to anybody who calls me. L'chol Hashem k'ruhu be'emes. That's provided your calling me is truthful. You've chosen to do so because you believe in me. You've chosen to do so because you believe that's where your salvation is. Not because it's a reflex action. So just as there are reflexes, there are physical reflexes, so there are spiritual reflexes. They are part of what appears to be our spiritual life that is in fact systematic and physical. And there is part of what appears to be our physical life that is in fact spiritual. So for example, when a person sits down and eats a meal, that appears to be physical. He's eating because he's hungry and he's enjoying the taste of the food. But we see the table as a mizbeach, we see the table as an altar, we have salt on the table for that reason, and on Shabbos we have a white tablecloth on the table for that reason. There's a whole aspect of our eating which is not physical, which is spiritual. So some things that appear purely physical, we elevate and make them spiritual. But in the same way, some things that look spiritual are in fact physical, they're in fact systematic, they're environmental, they're not really spiritual. And we have to be very clear in our own spiritual growth to be able to differentiate, be able to pull them apart and see that the physical acts in a physical way, that the spiritual acts in a spiritual way, and that the two are synthesized in the right way, in the correct way. Not that we turn our religion into a system, or that we turn our bodies into a religion. And that's what one finds happening, and contemporarily, unfortunately, one finds a lot of that happening, where the spirituality and the Yiddishkeit is expressed in a way where young people deny the physical part of their existence. They're very holy, they're very spiritual, and they're very... I think I've told you several times of the story when I came to Gated Yeshiva and I led a bit of a revolution because the food was inedible. Didn't mind that the food wasn't good, but I just had problems whether one could say brachas on the food. It was a religious problem, it wasn't a spiritual problem. And when I complained to the Rosh Yeshiva and he wanted to check up on me, he called his senior boys in and he said, "I hear that the food's no good, is that true?" And a few of them answered, they said, "You know, Rosh Yeshiva, to tell you the truth, we couldn't tell you. We don't come to Yeshiva to eat. We don't even notice what the food is like." He said, "Really? Angels? I can't teach angels. I think you should find another Yeshiva." There's a human side to us. And there's nothing wrong in acknowledging the human side. And the human side gets hungry, and the human side enjoys good food, and that has to be acknowledged. There's a part of us, there's a human body, that human body has to be kept healthy. There's a health aspect. There's a fitness aspect. We can't let ourselves go to rack and ruin. That's problematic. It's not good enough saying, "But I'm a spiritual being, I don't care about these things, I don't think about these things." That's turning the physical into spiritual. That's not what we're meant to do. That's denying the existence of the physical. No, Zois, Torah, Sametzoro, and this is Ishoki, Tazrio. There's a physical part that has halachic implication, and we need to acknowledge the existence of the physical part and treat it physically before you can elevate it to spiritual. You cannot elevate something to spirituality if you don't acknowledge its existence. First you have to acknowledge its existence. There's an animal part to me, and that has to be recognized and acknowledged and then elevated. And likewise, what one finds happening is the opposite. The people's spirituality is brought down to a physical system, where the Yiddishkeit becomes routine. It's externally motivated. It's caused by pressures, by social pressures and environmental pressures and pressures from peer groups. It's caused by slogans that are drummed into people. It's reflex action. Somebody came to see me the other day and they said they want to become from. They're terrified. I said, "What are you terrified of?" It was a young lady. She said, "Well, I've been around to various places, and it seems to me that I'm being told that if I just go through a whole list of things, then I'll come out the other side fine, and I'll go to heaven, and I'll be religious and spiritual. But it just doesn't seem right. What about me? Do I just have to adopt a personality, and then it's okay? But what do I do with my real personality? What do I do with the real me? Nobody's explained to me." What a beautiful question that was. Somebody who realized the danger of turning Yiddishkeit into another system, into another mechanized process, into another part of the physical being. So do you realize what's happening? We're taking our physical being and denying its existence in order to make us feel all spiritual, and we're taking our spiritual religious lives and we're turning it into a physical system, and we're missing on both sides. We're not enjoying life and we're not growing in Torah, and that's why we get stunted. That's exactly what happens. There's no enjoyment, there's no fun, there's no humor, there's no pleasantness. It's all stiff because you deny the existence of all that. Can't be. Not allowed to laugh. You know, real gods don't laugh. There's nothing funny about life. This is serious business. It's weakness if I laugh. So everybody walks around miserable because that's the religious thing to do. There's no pleasure, there's no leisure, there's no socializing in a relaxed sort of way, because that's all denied. And what about the spiritual life? That becomes systems driven. Yeah, regimented one. Does this, you do this, you don't do this, everything. You know the lists of what you've got to do and what you don't have to do, and you go to all sorts of extremes in the regimentation of the system, and now you feel religious. You're missing the boat on both sides. It's not religion and it's not life. It's missed on both sides. Switch them around and we might be getting somewhere. Acknowledge that there is a physical life and that has to be acknowledged. There is a spiritual life and that has to be driven by choice, by desire, by will, by spirituality, and then synthesize the two together, then put the two together. And then you start developing that kind of human being which the Torah really requires of us. And then we're able to understand how that first, that Ruach Elokim that's merachefes al pnei hamayim, that spirit, that Ruchoi shel Melech HaMashiach, Hashem starts off the creation and it creates the ultimate of human achievement, the spiritual soul, the soul of Melech HaMashiach. And then he starts evolving the human body, however he does so. He creates the physical world, he creates the mineral world, the vegetable world, he creates the fishes, and then he creates the animals, and then out of all that he creates the human being. And then he takes that spirit, and he takes that human being, and he puts them together. He puts them together in a way that sometimes drives us insane. He puts them together in a way that they pull at each other, because they're going in opposite directions in every way. The spiritual side is evolving within the individual, and it's devolving in society. The physical side is devolving within the individual and evolving within society. All these different pulls and these different dynamics. And he says, now human being, I've also given you an intellect, I've given you a mind, I've given you a personality to take these different dynamics, to synthesize them together, to match them together, to ensure that not only are you driven to enormous heights, but that the heights you are driven to are uniquely yours. That the heights you're driven to are your own creation, your own achievement, that for which you merit reward.